All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Tribune Tower. Here till 5. Steve Grzanch with the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive right here on WGN. It's Monday, and that means it's time for a joke. My dad will call in and tell a jokey time. That's coming up. That means the Monday morning movie reviews are about to happen. We'll talk about the movies, and we'll talk about the box office. And Eric was out sick last week, and so we didn't get his final wrap-up of the South by Southwest Film Festival, so we'll get that as well. We are also going to talk about weird drive-through businesses, and we have got jokes here that only smart people will get, and that'll lead us into my dad's joke. So that's coming up. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show. The best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, it is Monday morning, and that means it's time for some movie reviews. And we've got Eric Childress and Colin Suter from eFilmCredit.com, RogerEbert.com, and more. Join me every Monday morning to review the new movies. And let's bring Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
How are you feeling?
Better. Much better.
Good. And Colin is here. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
All right. Well, welcome back, guys. Okay, we got a bunch of stuff to talk about this week, and including, Eric, we'll get your final wrap-up at South by Southwest.
Yeah.
And a little bit later on, and some box office stuff. There's kind of some surprising numbers this week.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so we'll get to that, but we got to review the new movies. And Colin, you are the only one who saw Wilson, unfortunately, and I'm really, really curious about this movie. So tell everybody about Wilson.
Yeah, this is based on the graphic novel by the guy who did Ghost World. Daniel Clovis, I think is his name.
Yep.
It follows a character not unlike someone we would see in that film and almost has the same kind of outlook as the two girls from that film. And he's played by Woody Harrelson. And he's a bit of a crank. He's an outsider, you know, and an extrovert. When it comes to talking to strangers, he'll just side up next to a guy in the men's room and start talking to him or take a seat on an empty bus next to the one other person that's on the bus with him and try to get to know him. That's the kind of guy he is. And he has an ex-wife played by Laura Dern. And he learns from her that she did not get an abortion 15 years ago, but she did, in fact, have a kid and gave her up for adoption. So this is kind of his shot at happiness once he learns this. And so they do some detective work, and they find the kid living in a nice suburban home. And they, introduce themselves to her at a shopping mall, and then eventually they become part of her life, and they start going out on, having outings together, at amusement parks and such. And she's very much like the girls in Ghost World, and she's played by an actress named Isabella Amara. And she, she's an outsider like him, and she kind of takes a liking to these two after a while. But, she's also dealing with being a teenager and, Wilson's, inept social behavior and his lack of filter tends to make every bad situation worse. So this is, a movie that is centered around a character that is meant to be unlikable, but it's sort of in an endearing way, not unlike, Bill Murray in St. Vincent or Paul Giamatti in American Splendor. He's just these cranky characters who live alone and, who hate everything about society, but they're meant to be very funny. And Harrelson is doing his damnedest to be the best kind of character in that way. The problem is the movie just abruptly switches tones, periodically. And, there are scenes of slapstick that don't really belong. They kind of go against, the overall, the rest of the film. It's directed by Greg Johnson, who did The Skeleton Twins. And with that film, I thought he did a really effective job of, you know, balancing the comedy and the drama and the pathos and everything and the sadness. And here, you just feel it trying to be, you know, like an Alexander Payne film, but, you know, without really the sort of discipline to, you know, maintain a tone throughout the whole thing. And so the film feels really off, even though everybody's given a good performance. Everybody is, you know, the actors seem to be on the right page with each other. But there's something about the directing that just is, just doesn't flow very well. And so it ends up, you know, Woody Harrelson's character ends up coming off more irritating than anything, and not in the way that is, you know, makes us really care about him in the way that the movie would want to do. You know, St. Vincent, I thought, succeeded where this movie kind of fails. You know, unfortunately, with such a great cast, you know, I can't really recommend it.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I mean, if come across it on cable, give it a shot, you know, but, cause there's great actors here. But you know, it just, by the end, I just kind of just, didn't care.
That's too bad. I mean, I like Daniel Clowes' work. And I loved the Skeleton Twins. And I love Woody Harrelson.
Right? Yeah. No.
Well, okay. That's too bad. All right. Well, that's Wilson. It is playing. It's in it's like 7 theaters here in the Chicagoland area, so you can check it out if you want to. All right, Eric.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us, and I will join you on this one since I've seen it. Why don't you tell everybody about Chip? Oh, by the way, none of us saw the Power Rangers movie. But apparently a ton of other people did, judging by that. I never expected that movie to make $40 million, but we'll talk about that a little bit later on. Anyway, tell us about Chips, Eric.
Okay. Well, this is the big screen adaptation of the television show that ran from 6 seasons from 1977 to 1983. And we don't have Eric Estrada and Larry Wilcox, obviously, but we do have Michael Pena and Dax Shepard in the roles that they originated. In this version, Dax Shepard's character was a former X Games motorcycle stunt guy and has gone through just broken just about everything in his body and is desperate to save his marriage. And we know he's desperate to save his marriage because it's the one thing he says in every single scene in the entire film. He's married to Kristen Bell, his real-life wife, and he's so desperate to save his marriage and retain some former glory that he joins the California Highway Patrol for some reason. And Michael Pena, his Poncherello, or that's his going to be his undercover name because he actually works for the FBI, and he is part of a case tracking some potential California Highway Patrolmen or cops in general who may be ripping off armored cars in spectacular fashion on highways and whatnot. Not much of a mystery to who is doing this. We find out very early that it's actually done by Vincent D'Onofrio's character.
There's a shocker.
Yeah.
Castin D'Onofrio is the heavy.
Yeah. And quite heavy he is in the movie. And he's doing it because his son is on heroin and hoping to give him a better life. So there's a lot of really weird script choices in this film. Okay, well, it's a Chips movie, okay? And clearly they have decided to take the route of your 21 Jump Street films and I guess a little bit of the upcoming Baywatch film. They know it's a goofy premise and just try to make a goofball time out of it. The problem is Dax Shepard is not much of a director. He's certainly not much of a writer and is even less of a leading man. This is really kind of a spectacular fail all around. And it's really unfortunate because Michael Pena is really trying to do something in this, just trying to do something in this movie. I mean, Dax Shepard seems to put all of his attention directorially into the shots of the motorcycles and the chase scenes, you know, going through the highway, which some of them, there was some nice work, camera work there. And he directed a movie a few years ago called Hit and Run that also was very, very choice in making a point of the car scenes in that film. And he does the same thing here at Chips. But as a writer and director and star of comedy, this movie takes like the just all the basis things you can possibly think of and tries to mine something out of it that just doesn't exist. Really old jokes, you know, jokes about homophobia and sexual problems and, you know, guys touching and stuff. And it's just all none of that stuff works. And on top of it, the movie has kind of a really a real violent streak in it. There's some really just like horrific violence in this film. And I mean, I have seen better, you know, I know, again, this is a Chips comedy, so maybe we shouldn't be too critical of the police work done in this movie, but I've literally seen better police work done in the Police Academy films, any of them. It was just sad to watch. In fact, there's one joke in the movie that I laughed at, and it's a joke that is actually then ruined by them actually changing the meaning of what I was actually laughing at to begin with. And I'm just going to say it involves Michael Pena walking out of a toilet. That's all I'm going to say. This movie, it's not funny. It's a waste of time. There's so many things that I'm sure you can mention, Nick, too, that why this movie doesn't work, but it's really bad.
Yeah. All right, we got a break, and we'll come back, and I'll give you my review of Chips, the latest film from Dax Shepard, and so that's what's coming up. We got a break here. We got the news coming up, and after the news, more movie reviews, and I'll tell you what I thought of Chips. It's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome back, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trip Tower. We're here till 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad will call in a little bit later and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about real but very weird drive-through businesses. We've got 15 jokes that only smart people will find funny, and that's going to lead into my dad's joke. And that's what's coming up here. Our phone number and text is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. So like us right now. All right. We are in the middle of the Monday morning movie reviews. And before the break, Eric told us about Chips, the latest big screen adaptation of a TV show written and directed by Dax Shepard. And he didn't like it. And that's Eric. And let's say hello to Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello.
All right. Well, I think I liked it a little bit. Well, clearly, I didn't actually despise it, so I guess I liked it a little bit more than you did. You know, you mentioned the chase scenes and the stunts and stuff like that. Some of the stuff in the movie is really quite good in that regard. Now, the movie doesn't make a lick of sense, but clearly Dax Shepard, you know, judging by this and Hit and Run, his favorite movie's got to be like Smokey and the Bandit. And it's got, you know, it's clearly, I mean, that's just what that's what his strength is. And you're right. I mean, this is a really a terrible script. He's not, you know, not a real great visual comedic director, but he does nail the action scenes, I got to say. There is some serious, I was shocked at how, the level of violence in certain scenes and how some of the violence like is played for laughs.
Yeah.
There's a very shocking beheading at one point in the movie.
Yeah, that turns into a key plot point that just shows you how bad the police work is.
Well,
in this movie.
The other thing about it, Eric, is that Michael Pena's character, first of all, when And I'm being very, you know, this is really stupid for me to even analyze any of this.
Yeah.
But, like, when he reveals to Dax Shepard that he is indeed FBI, because he does it pretty early in the movie, you know, it's,
yeah.
I'm not spoiling anything,
mm-hmm.
you know, because he's undercover as an FBI. He's supposed to be, you know, the California Highway Patrol to nail these guys. But when he reveals it, why doesn't he stop calling him Ponch? Why doesn't he just tell him his real name? And I just there was stuff like that, and I know I shouldn't even be. And when I'm thinking about stuff like that, it proves that the movie's not escapist, like really hilarious escapist entertainment. Because I was thinking about why is he still calling him Ponch?
Well, my favorite part is the beheading, though, because like someone's head gets lopped off on a motorcycle, and they have pictures of the head with the helmet still on, but they keep saying they can't identify the body.
I know.
But then there's a picture of the guy's head, and John goes, I know that guy,
yeah.
And they Google him.
Yeah, and they Google him, right. No. But the other thing about it is you're talking about bad police work. Now, at the beginning of the movie, when you're introduced to both characters, all right, Pena's character is in Miami. Working at the FBI, but you don't know that at the onset of the movie. At the beginning, you think that he is yet another cinematic getaway driver. But so you think he's a getaway driver for these bank robbers, right? But in fact, you find out that he's actually you eventually find out that he's undercover FBI. Okay,
mm-hmm.
He almost kills like 50 people on the sidewalk.
Yep.
When he's driving, like
and that doesn't get him suspended. But apparently, not calling back your superior, that does it.
Now, yes, this is you know, so all of that stuff, like within, and I knew the plot point already that he was an undercover FBI, and I'm like, why is he driving on the sidewalk, almost killing innocent civilians?
Right.
I will say this about it: I laughed a few times. I think Michael Pena and Dax Shepard actually have some good chemistry going, and it's and again, you know, as you mentioned, Eric, Michael Pena is just awesome, and he's just great. He's great in everything, and he really isn't given much to work with here at all. But he manages to squeeze out some laughs. And
yeah, I would actually recommend people. There's a movie that's actually that I don't even think got released here. That's coming out on Blu-ray and DVD in a couple of weeks, called War on Everyone.
Yes.
That we played at our festival last year.
Yeah.
If you want to see two guys that have chemistry, him and Alexander Skarsgård in this movie, much funnier.
Yeah.
Much funnier. And it's a cop movie, too.
Okay. All right. And I also just want to mention very quickly that, you know, there were certain things that I laughed at. I have no idea, Eric, and maybe you can explain this to me.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell is Ed Begley Jr. doing in the movie for 5 minutes?
I don't know.
Singing to Rosanna by Toto? And that actually made me laugh.
Yeah, I chuckled when I heard the song.
Well, yeah, but finally when they get to the point where it's like, just turn off the Toto! That cracked me up.
Yes.
So anyway, there are certain things. And I have to say that the stuff between Adam Brody and Michael Pena I thought was really funny.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that cracked me up. Like, he has a tendency to shoot Adam Brody. And
mm-hmm.
and it cracked me up. Some of that stuff, and I laughed more than I clearly laughed more than you did. But I'm not recommending it. So all right. Now I have not seen the latest Terrence Malick movie. I didn't get a chance to see it this weekend. So Colin, why don't you tell us about Song to Song?
All right. Well, here's what I made out of the story. I just paint it in broad strokes because you kind of have to with this.
I'm putting my feet up, Colin. I'm just putting my feet up.
I know. Ryan Gosling is a songwriter. He's falling for Rooney Mara, who is an aspiring singer. Michael Fassbender plays her ex, and he's a greedy music mogul who's trying to make a deal with Gosling's character. And Natalie Portman plays a girl who comes in later in the film and hooks up with Fassbender, I think. And it all takes place in Austin, Texas, during the South by Southwest Music Festival. That's kind of how the story, you know, this is Terrence Malick. And so the storyline is kind of taking a backseat to, you know, his prose as a filmmaker and, you know, his poetic sensibilities. That's the way it's always been, you know, for the most part. But for the last three films, To the Wonder, Knight of Cups, and this one, I mean, that is definitely more the case than ever before. And so it can be it can test your patience, even for a fan like I am. Big fan of those first five films that he made. Always will be. But he's basically, testing my patience now with, the more prolific he gets. I don't like the prolific Terrence Malick. I like the hermit that pops his head out of his hole every, 6 years with a new film, because, there's clearly a lot of thought put into it. Whereas now he is just, him and Emmanuel Lubezki are just going anywhere they can with a camera, making some very gorgeous cinema. I mean, that will always be the case. He will always be, responsible for some of the most beautiful images I've ever seen in any film. And that's certainly the case here. If you're a Malick fan and you plan on seeing this, you may as well see it on the big screen and get the most out of it. Because as a viewing experience, as an emotional experience, as an experience of connection, it's nowhere. It's empty. It is complete nonsense. And, I counted 13 walkouts during the screening. I don't know what studios are thinking by having nighttime screenings of these movies anyway, but I mean, really, I don't know what sort of word of mouth they're trying to generate. But, this is strictly for Terrence Malick fans, and they're going to go regardless. But, for this film, I mean, of the last three, I think it's my favorite, that for no other reason than, the soundtrack. Is really good. It is beautiful to look at, and there's a cameo in the middle of the film at the South by Southwest Film Festival that is among the funniest things I've seen this year, which is not something you normally say about any Terrence Malick film. But when it happened, I was like, "Oh, can we see a movie about him?" Oh no, there's a bug and there's a flower. Okay, all right, I guess not. So it is, if he would just give me a sense of geography and a sense of who these characters are and where they are and whose house they're in and whether or not they live together or if they're, is this California? Is this Texas? Where are they now? If I could just get that, a handle on that, maybe I could go along with the rest of it. But even in basic, simple, fundamental storytelling skills, the movie fails. And so the rest of it fails, too. I hear he's doing a period piece next, so maybe that will force him to maybe pay more attention to the stuff that he did before he got on this trail of meandering. So yeah, this is the third or fourth. I haven't seen the IMAX the nature movie, but from what I hear, this would be the fourth disappointment from Terrence Malick.
Mm. Okay. I can pretty much figure out what Eric's going to say.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Well, let me just say that this was the opening night film at the South by Southwest Film Festival this year, and I waited in line for over an hour and a half to see this movie. Think about that for a second. Okay. But I will say that a couple things that I haven't said before about Malick, because everything Colin said I agree with, and including the fact that it is of the last bunch, and I didn't get to see the IMAX The Voyage of Time movie either, but it's the best looking of the last few that he's done. It's always gorgeous to look at. It is about the only thing that kept me awake during most of the movie. But I will say this. One, I think as snarky as I could possibly be, I think this is actually my favorite period of Terrence Malick's work, because it's actually bringing all of the champions around to my side of thinking on this guy, and that gives me a little bit of joy. And the other thing I will say, and this is a bit more serious, is that I think it's becoming more and more apparent just how little respect this guy actually has for actors. And that's a whole debate that we can have probably at some other time. But you think about it, we're just watching this movie and watching the talent that he has on display. You got Fassbender and you got Ryan Gosling in scenes together, and you know Rooney Mara is there, and then there are, you know, there are cameos by, you know, a lot of really famous musicians, and even, you know, perhaps even amateur musicians that would be nice to just get a little bit of sense of it, you know, some of the in this setting that he has. I don't know if it's all South by Southwest. I think some of it's Austin City Limits, but he filmed this thing back as far back as 2012. And apparently he had 8 hours of footage that he put together and then just crammed this 2 hour plus movie out of it. And you could tell even when Gosling and Fassbender and Mara were on stage at South by Southwest introducing this movie. This was before Malick actually came out of hiding to do a press conference the next day. When they were asked about working with Malick, you could tell that they were kind of baffled. Like they didn't really. They were trying to be as politically on point as they possibly could about working with a guy that people consider a legend. But you could just tell in their demeanor that they didn't know what the hell they were doing on set every day.
Well, Eric, you know that. Did you read the Thomas Lennon piece?
No.
Colin, you've read it, right?
Yeah.
About the Knight of Cups?
Yeah, about him being in Knight of Cups. And he just wrote this piece about – you should look it up online because it's pretty amazing. It's Thomas Lennon. It's like Thomas Lennon doesn't even know why he's in the movie.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that makes absolute sense. And maybe I don't want to spoil exactly the person that Colin's referring to about that shows up as a cameo. You know, in any other movie, it wouldn't be a cameo. He might be an actual character, but he shows up, I don't know, an hour into the movie. I think we're talking about the same person, Colin. And it really pissed me off because one, like Colin, I wanted to follow this guy around a little bit longer. And two, it'd be nice to have more footage of this guy from 5 years ago before he got sick, you know? And I just, it just really angered me when he, like, doesn't appear anymore in this movie to just follow these drifting idiots around. And, you can't even get a sense for who these characters are. You know, it's not even unfair to call them idiots because Malick doesn't give them any room to grow, breathe, or anyone to give a performance. You know, some of the times their voices aren't full display. Sometimes they're muted. Just like Knight of Cups. I'm tired of this guy. Go back into hiding.
Okay. I haven't seen it yet, but I happen to be pro Malick. Although I haven't liked, I didn't see the IMAX thing. Didn't like To the Wonder. I didn't hate Knight of Cups. I thought Knight of Cups was okay. But I am looking forward to this, if only because it's Terrence Malick. But yeah.
Well, you better hurry. These movies don't stick around for very long.
No, they don't.
If you are pro Knight of Cups, well, you have that as an advantage because it's just like Knight of Cups.
Okay. All right. Okay. That's disappointing. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress, Colin Suter, talking about the movies, and we'll come back. We got much more to talk about here. We've got the box office, and because Eric was off last week, he didn't get a chance to wrap up South by Southwest, so we'll get that done too. All right, we'll take a quick break here. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. How you doing? Monday morning, everybody. My dad will call in and tell a joke. We're doing the movie reviews right now, and we'll have box office, and Eric will wrap up his thoughts on South by Southwest Film Festival. But we got a few more movies to talk about. Eric, welcome back. And
hello.
Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
All right. Eric, why don't you tell us about Life?
Okay. This is a science fiction movie about it doesn't say exactly when it's set, but we'll just assume that it's set relatively between the present and the future. And it's about a manned mission to Mars, and they're on their return trip home. Six-man-woman crew. Jake Gyllenhaal is the pilot. Rebecca Ferguson is the chief, the doctor, and Ryan Reynolds is on board, I guess, as comic relief. they're on their way back, and there's been some debris almost crippled their space station, but saved in the nick of time. But what's going on in the spacecraft is a bit more interesting in that they have distracted some life, a life form from the dirt that they've collected on Mars. And the sort of the chief science officer on board begins kind of playing with it and begins to sort of develop a life of its own, and begins to sort of communicate with them, you know, just by movement and touch and stuff. And then at one point, when the organism apparently perceives a threat, it attacks back and attaches itself to the science officer and causes some really horrific bodily harm to it. And then it escapes its confines and begins to slither its way through every crevice of the ship in an effort to keep itself alive. So while they're on their course to Earth, they have to deal with the fact that this thing is getting bigger and faster and smarter, and they don't want it to reach the mainland of Earth. So basically you have a film that is right up there in the mold of Alien, and throw in a little bit of Species, and just for good measure to throw in a little Gravity as well. These are movies that I tend to like. I've always had kind of a soft spot for movies, you know, particularly space movies that, again, probably since the mold of Alien, you know, deal with some kind, you know, whether it be a alien threat or a scientific threat that threatens the crew and begins to, you know, potentially pick them off one by one, always, you know, has held kind of an interest to me. This one's interest began to wear off pretty quickly. It's not a particularly long film. It doesn't take forever to get to the creature sort of taking over, but it doesn't take a short time either. And this movie can't quite decide exactly what movie it wants to really be. Does it really want to be a full-blown creature feature? And I do give them credit for the creature design. I actually liked the idea that it wasn't just another, you know, an alien that grows. It's this actually sort of gelatinous octopus-like life form that that does, you know, begin to grow exponentially. I kind of like the idea of that. But beyond that, it never quite develops itself into a, you know, a true horror film, a thriller of that sort. And then every once in a while, it tries to sort of slow things down even further and try to drop some sort of nugget about the meaning of life and things like that. But even those moments feel kind of short shrifted, and it just seems like they can't quite pull the trigger on whether they're trying to go for something a little bit more Kubrickian or if they're trying to do something more Ridley Scott. And ultimately, and you know, without giving too much away, I will say that the ending of this movie is actually quite a cruel joke for a couple reasons, which I obviously I don't want to spoil, but there's just sort of kind of an unfairly cruel joke played not so much on the audience, but on the characters in the movie that it involves. And it really reminded me a lot of another movie that one of the actors in the film was actually in. Maybe you can figure that out on your own. Again, I don't want to spoil too much, but I pardon the pun, but the movie just kind of felt very lifeless.
Okay. Eric, Colin, hang on. When we come back, we'll hear Colin's thoughts on life and on the movie. And then my thoughts on the movie as well, as we continue with the Monday morning movie reviews. We got a break right now for the news on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Good morning, everybody. We're here till 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday morning. That means my dad will call in and tell a jokey time. We're going to talk about very weird but very real drive-through businesses. We also have a list of 15 jokes that only smart people will get, and that'll lead us into my dad's joke. All of that and more. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can also check us out on Twitter at Nick D Show, but the best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page. So like us, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Okay, we are reviewing the new movies, and before the break, Eric told us all about the movie Life and what he thought of it, and now we're going to find out what Colin thought of it, and we'll find out what I thought of it. And Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Colin, what did you think?
I think I liked it a little bit more, but I still have some issues with it. I like it mainly for the craft of it. I think when the movie is, you know, going for the scare and going for, you know, the sort of the tense moments, I felt tense. I felt a little uneasy about it. You know, it kind of played into a lot of my fears, and I thought it did so rather effectively in those moments. I think as far as, you know, what the movie wants to be, you know, yeah, there's a little bit of gravity, especially at the beginning. I believe the opening scene is one shot. You know, it looked like that's what they were going for. And, you know, so then after that, there's no more of that sort of flashy filmmaking. After that, it's done being gravity, and now it wants to be Alien for the rest of the film. It's obviously not as good as Alien, but it is, I think, in its best moments, it is something that is tense and a little scary. Problem is that the characters are so forgettable. The ultimate experience of it is so forgettable because, you know, there's never really, there's often not a clear sense of, you know, what their next plan is. When they start talking about, you know, well, how, you know, what's our next plan of attack? That failed. What are we going to do next? And then they talk about it and you're like, wait, what? What are they doing? Wait, slow down. What? So you're just kind of like, well, I'll just watch it play out and see what happens. That was a problem for me when watching it. I don't have a problem with the ending. I kind of like the ending that they had in there. I saw it coming. I knew what it was going to be as they were setting it up. But I like that they still went with it, because usually that's the kind of ending that you see as a, you know, special feature on a DVD, you know, the alternate ending that didn't take because, you know, the test audiences didn't like it, you know, that sort of thing. So I kind of like, you know, what happened there. And I thought it was done pretty effectively. So I don't know. I definitely think I like it more than Eric did, mainly because I think there's some strong filmmaking here. It just needed a better script, really.
Yeah, Colin, I think I'm with you on this one. There are things in it that I liked, and there's some craft here that's good. And I like the as you mentioned, Eric. You know, the way the creature is presented, and how it changes, and those sequences involving that. But the characters are just non-existent. These are cardboard, you know, one-dimensional characters at best. So there's really nothing to really grab you emotionally. But I do think there are sequences in it that are good. I too like the ending. And I don't know. You can't, you know, you watch any kind of movie like this, and you know, it's Alien. You know, when I'm watching, I'm like, man, I would just rather be watching Alien right now. And it's, you know, it's the same kind of concept. I mean, obviously the creature is different because the creature in Alien is, you know, that's iconic and you can't mess with it. So they went a different route on it, but I think there are some good moments in the film. There are some sequences that I think are well directed. I think the effects are good and it certainly looks good. But I don't think I'm going to recommend it. It's just that I'm more in the middle. And I'm leaning towards Colin more than I am Eric here. It begs to compare it to Alien. You know, for like most of its running time, and I can't abide by that. So I'm not recommending it. So and by the way, I got to tell you, as crazy and as kind of awesome as the Alien Covenant trailer is,
mm-hmm.
I don't trust it because of Prometheus.
Right.
I just don't. You know.
Or Ridley Scott.
Or Ridley Scott. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I don't know. And it's a pretty – I'll tell you, the trailer's pretty badass, you know, but I don't know.
Here's what I heard. If you didn't hear, funny enough, after Song to Song on opening night, they actually showed the original Alien at South by Southwest in the big Paramount Theater with Ridley Scott and Fassbender there. And actually, they showed a couple like new scenes from Alien Covenant. I wasn't there for it, But what I heard happen is that one of the scenes they showed actually shows them killing off like four main characters.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah. Like four like recognizable character actors in one film. And everyone was like, wait, whoa, wait. So, yeah.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Oh, man. All right. Well, I'm not recommending the movie Life. So, but I am recommending the Eddie Murphy, Martin Lawrence movie.
I recommend that, too.
Yeah, I like that movie. I don't care what anybody says. I enjoy that film. Okay. All right. Well, let's see. Colin, why don't you tell us about T2 Trainspotting?
All right. Well, this is the sequel to the big 1996 film about Scottish heroin addicts. And the entire main cast has returned. Ewan McGregor as Mark Renton. And he returns after 20 years of being abroad, and he comes back to get in touch with his friends and family again. Well, as you may remember, the last time Mark saw his friends, he stole a bag full of money from them and took off, leaving only a few thousand for Spud, the sort of goofy, innocent one who never had it in for anybody. And now Spud is fighting addiction and hasn't forgotten any details of his life with Mark and the gang 20 years ago, so much so that he might even write a book about it. And he, you know, never really had any aspirations to be a writer, but, you know, maybe now he will. Meanwhile, Sick Boy has been running cons involving, you know, making blackmail videos with his hooker girlfriend or would-be girlfriend. And he's not too fond of Mark being back, but he figures he might be able to make it useful for him. And then there's Begbie, the psychotic, alcoholic, non-heroin user of the bunch. And he has a deadly grudge against Mark and has been doing time because of that deal all these years. And he will do whatever he can to exact revenge against him. So those are the main characters. And, of course, you know, back then, Kelly MacDonald was also on that poster. And she's in this, too. She's in, you know, one scene. Kind of wish there was more, but whatever. But, you know, Danny Boyle's returned. The author, you know, has, you know, this is based on his books, Irvine Welch. He brought these characters back. And you can tell the spirit is still with these guys. You know, Danny Boyle, obviously, I mean, you know, even, you know, we're 20 years removed. 20 plus years removed from the first Trainspotting and from Shallow Grave. And, you know, as we've seen from Danny Boyle's work, he has not lost his touch over the years. You know, he is still making bold, stylistic choices that are flashy and engaging and never deter from the story that is being told. And that's the same case here. This is definitely, he's definitely gotten in touch with these characters again, and I like what they did with these characters. I like what they do with Spud in particular. You know, I think he's the soul of the film, and I think that's a great choice. I think Ewan McGregor is really, you know, still terrific as Mark in it. And I think, you know, yeah, okay, it's a nostalgic trip. No question about it. There's definitely nods, obvious nods to the original film. And they show flashbacks to the original film every now and then. Maybe a little too much sometimes. But, you know, I think it's more to bring people up to speed who maybe haven't seen Trainspotting in a while. I had a ball with this film. I thought it was a great reunion, and also just a great movie about aging and, you know, how you can never, you know, really get back to, you know, those days in your teens or your 20s, you know, when you were just, you know, living a carefree life. On the other hand, you know, there's demons in that life as well that you also don't want to go back to. You know, I think it's illustrated beautifully when Marx puts the needle on the record and you hear just the first drum of Lust for Life and he immediately removes the needle from the record like, nope, don't want to go there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's so, that's such a great illustration of what this movie is about. And I had a great time with it. So I was more than happy to be back with this gang again.
Okay. All right. Hang on, guys. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll find out what Eric thought of T2 Trainspotting, and then I'll tell you what I thought of T2 Trainspotting as we continue with the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on WGN. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And we're in the middle of the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com and RogerEbert.com and more join me. And let's welcome Eric back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, before the break, Colin told us about T2 Trainspotting and highly recommended it. And now we're going to find out what Eric and I thought of it. Eric, you go first.
Yeah, I liked it a lot too. And Colin, touched upon a number of things that a lot of people have been sort of in the reviews that I've read have sort of knocked it a little bit for being a bit of a nostalgia trip. But to me, that's exactly what this film is. One of the many things that this film is actually about is we've had this this nostalgia trip that this world has been on for a while now, and it just seems like it's a word we can't get away from. And this movie, clearly, it's 21 years later, and there are clips inserted of the original movie into the film as the characters have these remembrances and things like that. And I think a bit of that is also, you can kind of look at this as sort of like a self-commentary on Boyle's own career. I mean, when this guy broke out, pretty much with Shallow Grave, there were people that really dug that film, and there were other people like myself who sort of saw it as a little bit more flash over substance. But then Trainspotting came along with a first hour that I still think is pretty flawless, and a film that I had not seen in probably 20 years, actually, until I saw T2, and then I actually watched Trainspotting again this weekend, and damn if that film doesn't hold up too. But this one I had an absolute blast at. It's weird that we say we had fun revisiting a bunch of Scottish heroin addicts, but these characters and the actors behind their personas, really there's a very endearing quality to who these characters are and what they represent. The three of us might not be heroin addicts, but we can certainly, in some respect, recognize the sort of the choices that these guys made as in regards back then to growing up and now with growing old. There's stuff in this movie that made me laugh hysterically. There's a moment in a bathroom where two characters realize they're on the other side of each other's door, and their reaction to that, I mean, it's like great silent comedy. I happen to love that the climax of this movie is clearly very Blade Runner inspired. I thought that was a trip. And it's kind of like watching, if like Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg were heroin addicts and made a movie. At sometimes there's the energy of this movie never wanes. Boyle, like Colin said, that's it's been a trademark of his for many years, and I think as he's gotten older, he's gotten better at it in incorporating the story and the style together. That I thought was missing a bit from the first half of his career, but I've been a big fan of him in the second half of his career, and a movie like this, I really think is up there. I think this is a really great film.
Yeah, I loved it. I absolutely loved it, and I loved revisiting these characters. And I don't know who's down on this thing in terms of like talking about it being a nostalgia trip. Why?
I don't think they're saying they're not down on the whole movie, but I think like Colin sort of mentioned, I guess it's a nostalgia trip kind of thing. I think that just gets brought up, as a not a full negative, but kind of like, yeah, I get it,
yeah,
kind of thing.
Well, some are arguing that the movie doesn't justify itself other than to be a nostalgia trip.
No, they're wrong.
I disagree with that. I disagree with that. This is a wholly satisfying film. And as you both mentioned, it's about aging. The movie is about how you change, and it's important to look back at that time. I mean, while I was watching this movie, I was thinking about the 20 years that passed while I was watching it and thinking about it afterwards, thinking about the 20 years that passed in my life since Trainspotting came out. And it made me think about that. I mean, I think that's the whole point of the movie. I think that's the entire point of the movie is to not only remember with these characters and watch this spectacularly innovative filmmaking that Danny Boyle. And I've run hot and cold on Danny Boyle over
me
the
too.
Years. You know, Trainspotting is still my favorite of the Danny Boyle films. It's my favorite of all of his movies. And this is, you know, like right up there. But it's not just about watching these characters and how they've changed and what they've done with them, which is really wonderful stuff, like really, really wonderful and thoughtful stuff. It's also hilarious, as you mentioned, like really funny. It has the same sort of bold energy that Trainspotting had, and yet it's very reflective. As funny as this movie gets and as crazy as this movie gets, at its core, it is a film about reflection. It's a movie, and I started to reflect upon my life, and, you know, you know, Eric, what you said was that, you know, like none of us are heroin addicts. I'm an alcoholic. And so that is a major change in my life over the past years. And that made me think about that, you know, about how choices that you make in your life. And I think that's an important thing, man. I think, you know, when a piece of art can do that, can make you not only be entertained by what's happening on the screen, you know, and remembering characters that you loved from a movie 20 years ago, but to also think about yourself and your life and your aging and what's different now than it was 20 years ago. That's a special thing, I think, man. And I love this movie. I absolutely loved it. Everybody in it is great. And if you're a fan of Trainspotting, I mean, this is just like tailor-made. You know, if you're a fan of Trainspotting, you're going to love this movie. Have you talked to anybody who likes Trainspotting and doesn't like this?
I haven't.
No, I haven't.
Now, why?
Then again, I don't know anyone that's seen it.
Okay. Well, it's a great movie. I loved it. And if you're a fan of Trainspotting, this is like a dream come true. And you know how, you know, it's what's really ironic about this, guys, is that how often this past year or so have we complained about sequels to movies from 20 years ago? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's like, who the hell wanted that? Who wanted Zoolander? And then this.
Because here's the difference between those movies and this, and not even a financial stake in them,
yeah.
Is that these are characters we want to revisit.
Absolutely.
20 years later. Mm-hmm. It's not a situation. It's not a plot device.
Yep.
It's, you know, they're, you know, think of, you know, the movies that have characters that you want to revisit,
yep.
You know, not just on another adventure, but just to see where they are.
Exactly. That's exactly what the deal is with this movie. It's like these are memorable characters from a movie that burst onto the scene. Like when Trainspotting came out, man, it was a thing, you know? And
yeah.
I had really never seen anything like it before. And like all of these actors were, nobody knew who they were, really. Nobody knew who these guys were in terms of acting.
Right.
And all of a sudden this thing comes out. It's like, what? And coming from Danny Boyle, and I can't stand Shallow Grave. And
right.
So this was a movie that made a bold statement and made a huge impact and has stayed with me for 20 years, man. I mean, so to revisit these guys, these are some of my favorite characters I've ever seen in movies. And to make a movie about these guys again, because you really want to know where they are, and to make it as significant as they made here, it's a great film. It's a great film.
They at the Q&A, Danny Boyle and Irvine Welch were there, and they're asking, you know, why is it called T2 Trainspotting? And they said, well, this is, you know, if what would these characters call this film if they could name it? They would be huge fans of Terminator 2, so they would call it T2 Trainspotting as a tribute and as a sort of knock, you know, just kind of slamming it and paying tribute to it at the same time.
Yeah.
Even though Trainspotting has nothing to do with Terminator.
No, of course not.
It's just how these guys' minds would think,
yeah.
You know, so that's like,
that's great. It's a terrific movie, and I highly, if you're a fan of Trainspotting, then you this is a must see. You got to see it. Okay, next week we've got The Boss Baby, Zookeeper's Wife, and Ghost in the Shell, right? Those are the big ones?
That's right.
Okay. All right. Well, Colin, thanks, man. Thanks for hanging out.
All righty.
We'll talk to you next week. And then, Eric, you hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric's going to hang out with us. We're going to take a break. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It is Monday morning, and that means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews, which we just did. And now we're going to talk about Eric Childress. Got back from Austin, Texas. He was down there for the South by Southwest Film Festival a couple of weeks ago. Spent some time there, saw a bunch of movies, covered a lot of them for our show. And he was out sick last week. We were going to do a wrap-up of talking about a few more movies and a wrap-up of the film festival. He was out sick, so he's going to do that right now, and then we'll talk box office as well. Our phone number and text number are 312-981-7200. We're going to hear from my dad to tell a jokey time. We're going to talk about weird but real drive-through businesses, and we've got a bunch of jokes that only smart people will get. All that coming up right here on a Monday morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, but let's welcome Eric Childress back. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
All right. Now, you were out last week, so we didn't get a chance to do a wrap-up.
Yeah.
You wanted to talk about a few more movies. We want to hear about a few more movies that you saw in Texas. So what else did you want to jump into now?
Well, I want to talk into one of my favorites from the fest that I didn't get a chance to talk about that, surprisingly enough, still hasn't been picked up yet, but I suspect that's going to change at some point this year.
Okay.
It's a movie called Hot Summer Nights.
Okay.
It was written and directed by a first-timer named Elijah Bynum, and as I tweeted out at the festival after this movie, I said, remember this name, because this is actually one of the more confident directorial debuts I've seen in some time. And you see a lot of directors just complete control of a story that we've seen many times before. I mean, I guess speaking of nostalgia, this is a movie set during the early 90s, based on a true story. They say mostly a true story about a teenager who's lost his father, and his mother sort of sends him to Cape Cod for the summer. He ends up making some interesting new friends, namely the local pretty boy in Cape Cod, who also happens to be the town's biggest small-time drug dealer. And he basically befriends him by showing him how he can expand his business. So he becomes a drug dealer. And the pretty girl, the prettiest girl in town, is played by Micah Monroe from It Follows. In a very striking performance, and she happens to be the sister of the drug dealer. And the two of them are estranged for reasons unknown, but they don't want anything to do, or she doesn't want anything to do with him, but this boy, who's played by Timothy Chalamet, who I mentioned before at Sundance, was in a movie that's coming out later this year called Call Me By My Name.
Yeah.
He played the Matthew McConaughey's son in Interstellar.
Yeah, yeah. The younger version, not the Casey Affleck
version.
Right.
And this kid's having a hell of a year. Two sort of summer based coming of age stories. That one's definitely going to be up for some Oscar consideration when it opens in November. But this one, it's very much, the director is clearly very influenced by Scorsese. Clearly very influenced by Boogie Nights, and I'm curious to see how you respond to that, because there's particularly one segment in the movie that features William Fichtner that is very Boogie Nights inspired, but because of the confidence of the people involved and the sort of the twist that they put on it, it doesn't feel like a direct ripoff.
And by the way,
like its own thing.
Speaking of Boogie Nights, I'm looking at the cast list. Thomas Jane is in this.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
He plays a cop in the film. Emery Cohen from Brooklyn.
Oh yeah.
Plays another drug dealer in the film. You'll never look at waffles the same way again.
All right.
This movie is just there's so much going on in it. Like you said, it's a nostalgia trip. It feels like Scorsese and Paul Thomas Anderson's, made a coming of age movie. I kind of walked out of this going like, wow, did not expect that.
Wow.
So Hot Summer Nights, it's called.
Okay. Hot Summer Nights. Very, very cool. Sounds great. I'm intrigued
yeah.
for sure. Okay. What else?
We didn't talk a lot about documentaries, but I saw one actually after I got back, and it's a documentary simply called Bill Nye Science Guy.
All right. I'm in.
Yeah, yes. Do we really need any more than that? Probably not. But this movie is, a document of, where the Bill Nye Show came from, how he's basically influenced, the complete generations of kids and got them interested in science. This is basically sort of the much more interesting version of the Al Gore documentaries.
Yeah.
Because climate change is a very big subject of this movie that gets quite political at times. It was something that pleased me pretty much to no end, because there are portions of this movie where he's debating the deniers and debating people who are anti-science, and how they try to dismiss him as just an actor on television rather than, you know, someone who's actually like working on actual space projects and weather projects and glacier projects and things like that. That this is not a guy to be dismissed. But at the same time, the movie is not always complimentary of Bill Nye because of actions that he took to get his show on the air originally, and also the idea that by giving credence in the debates to some of these science deniers, that he might actually be helping them more than he's helping the good side. So it has this really sort of interesting debate going on internally while offering, you know, a picture that of a guy that just makes you want to learn all about science all over again. I mean, I wish that, you know, he was my science teacher, because I didn't have very good science teachers throughout my schooling years. And I had a great time watching this movie. Like I said, I'm really happy that it got political, and I really hope people see it, because they're just, you know, there's an anti-science and an anti-intellectual thing going on in this country, has been for many years. I think at least since Idiocracy came out. So I think this is really worth taking a look at.
Okay, Bill Nye Science Guy documentary. Has that been picked up?
Not yet, to my knowledge.
Okay. There's no doubt that it'll be seen, no question about
right.
it.
Right.
So, okay, anything else?
A movie called The Ballad of Lefty Brown.
Okay.
It's a Western. Stars Bill Pullman as Lefty Brown, and basically the gimmick of this movie, and the gimmick's maybe a dismissive word, but it's basically if you had a John Wayne movie where John Wayne was killed off and the sidekick had to be the hero.
Okay.
Okay, and the John Wayne character in question in this movie is played briefly by Peter Fonda, who makes no bones that he's playing John Wayne.
Okay.
In the movie, he's pretty much doing the voice in the movie, and Bill Pullman as Lefty Brown is pretty much doing a variation on Walter Brennan.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
And it's an interesting take on the Western genre. I think sometimes it moves a little bit too slow for my taste. But Pullman hasn't been this good in a while. I think this is really one of his best performances. It's a gorgeous looking film, absolutely gorgeous looking film. I'm very curious to look at it again and see how it plays out, because it's not, you know, a complete shoot 'em up kind of thing. It's a bit more melancholy. It's not, you know, exceptionally plot heavy, but it takes that premise and it doesn't necessarily having fun with it. It's just taking it as seriously as it possibly can, and I think that they do a really nice job with it.
Okay, The Ballad of Lefty Brown. That sounds pretty good to me.
And no, that's pretty much the best of it,
okay.
Right there,
all
with
right.
All the other stuff that we talked about.
Okay, and overall, was your favorite movie the Disaster Artist? Was that your favorite of all the ones you saw?
No, it wasn't. I wouldn't say that was my favorite. I think my favorite at the fest was the movie Lucky with Harry Dean Stanton.
Mm-hmm.
With we talked about that before, where, you know, a 90-year-old atheist who's basically realizing that death may be coming, you know, soon for him, and having these reflective conversations with the people in his town and people in the bar and the diner, including David Lynch and Ron Livingston, and just a funny, beautiful film directed by John Carroll Lynch. That was my favorite. Disaster Artist might be the funniest.
Okay.
I will say that. And I think I said on your show that for anyone who's a fan of The Room and a fan of that phenomenon, it's a masterpiece. Mm. If you're unfamiliar with it, I'm very curious to hear your thoughts.
Okay. Yeah, I would be curious if somebody would see that movie and not know what was going on.
Yeah.
In terms of and never seeing The Room. I was always surprised that it took you so long to see The Room.
Yeah, well, because I never wanted to see it alone.
Oh, I see.
That was a movie, you know, Colin and I for years have gone to see bad movies and experienced bad movies together.
Right.
And I've got some other friends to do that too. But I just, you know, I'd known about The Room for, you know, forever.
Right.
But I was not about, I mean, I didn't have a copy of it. It wasn't, you know, readily available. I wasn't going to buy $30 for a Wizoo DVD production or whatever.
Right.
So I waited, and then Colin brought it to my house. He's like, we're watching this.
The first time I saw it, I was alone. The first time I saw the Room, I was just in my apartment, and I watched it, and I was like, what in God's name is this?
Yeah.
And then, but to see it like at the Music Box on a midnight, that's something.
Yeah, I've never seen it with a crowd.
Oh,
I'm not into group participation in theaters.
Yeah.
So I don't know how I'd react to that. But I'll tell you that since the first time seeing it with Colin, I probably watched it about a dozen times.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Since then, including on vacation. Because I was in Vegas last summer, like a month after I had seen the movie the first time, and I had bought the book. So I was poolside reading The Disaster Artist, and then I would go up to my room and watch some of the scenes. I'm like, I can't, wow.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, Franco does an amazing job with the film. I'm very curious to see if it translates to people who have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Okay, yeah. Eric, hang on, all right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress is going to hang out with us. When we come back, we got to talk about the box office. Eric writes about the box office in a piece he calls The Numbers Game. You can read it at movies.com. And we're going to talk about the weekend box office, the winners, the losers. And that's coming up right after we take a break for weather and traffic. And I've got your weather right now. Good morning. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Tribune Tower. Monday morning, we finished up the Monday morning movie reviews, talked a little bit about South by Southwest with a wrap-up with Eric. And now Eric and I are going to talk about box office. And it being Monday, my dad will call in and tell a joke in a little bit. But let's get Eric back in here. Welcome back, Eric.
Thank you.
All right. Tell everybody how they can watch you on the TVs.
Yeah. Every Thursday morning on WYCC television, whatever station that might be in whatever part of Chicago you are, or just look up Business First AM. That's the name of the show. And every Friday morning, or sorry, Thursday morning at 5 a.m., I do a segment called Movies and Money. We talk about the new movies of the week and what their the box office potential are.
Okay. And then you write about it as well. And we always on Monday morning talk about the weekend that has just happened. And wow, Beauty and the Beast, man. $88.3 million this weekend. It has made in America $316.9 million already. That's crazy.
10 days.
That's crazy.
10 days. This is headed for top 10 domestic gross of all time.
I can't believe it, to be honest with you. I mean, I knew it would be a big hit, but I didn't think it was just going to be.
I don't think anyone thought this quick, this fast.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew that the it was going to open huge. I you know, 300 million, you know, I said up to last week, 300 million was a guarantee. After last weekend, I said 400 million is a guarantee. Now you have to look at 500 million as a potential.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's just in the U.S. I mean, it's over 700 million worldwide. It's going to hit $1 billion with ease. And it's just a question of just how far up that chart it's going to climb.
Wow. And, yeah, I mean, I don't. I mean, I knew it was going to be big. I just didn't think it was going to be this big.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy. All right. Now, and this is another surprise.
Not as crazy as this.
Number two, Power Rangers, $40.5 million. What?
I don't like to be wrong. But I'm happy to admit when I'm wrong, and I think I said well, I wasn't on last week, but I've been saying for weeks, I'm like, I don't know who this movie is for.
Yeah,
the last Power Rangers movie made nothing,
mm-hmm.
And you know, I know this is, you know, it's a few years down the road, but was anyone nostalgia for? I mean, there are still Power Ranger shows on the air.
Yeah.
And, you know, was anyone ready for a PG-13 reboot? Apparently, yes.
I don't
know why. I don't get it. The reviews have not exactly been stellar. It's one thing to go from Adam West to Tim Burton,
For
Batman, you know, because there people were craving the different incarnation of that character that was in a comic book. But, you know, who was thinking, like, yeah, I need my Power Rangers to be grittier?
Yeah.
Just go watch any Marvel film, for God's sake.
Right. I don't know, man. That's just weird. 40 million. Do you think it's gonna drop pretty huge?
I think it's gonna drop huge. Yeah. I mean, I can't see this sustaining this now. The March movies that open to this kind of thing, this amount of money, have not done less than $122 million in the past. But I would bet the under on that.
Yeah.
Okay. Number three, Kong Skull Island with $14.4 million, bringing its total up to $133 million. Number four, Life, $12.6 million. What did this movie cost?
$58 million.
That's not a ton.
Not a ton, but you open at $12.6 million, yeah, you're going to struggle to make $30-$35 million.
Yeah.
So, again, I don't see a huge international tally for a movie like this, unless it is an alien film, but even those don't do massive business overseas.
Right.
So, this one just looked kind of DOA. People, yeah, you know, would rather wait for Alien Covenant.
Well, yeah. I think that's exactly what it is. I mean, people, yeah, are like, I'm not going to bother seeing this one in the theater because there's an alien movie, a real alien movie coming out.
And they moved this thing up, too, because I think this was originally supposed to open in May.
Oh, I remember the first trailers. It was May.
Yeah.
The first trailers, it was May. It was in May. And then they moved it up to March. I remember sitting in the theater going, wait a minute, they're moving this thing up to March.
They moved the alien movie into May, or they got the whiff that was going to happen, and they moved it into March.
Right.
And they've opened at a time when the family audiences are taking over. So no one wanted to see an R-rated alien ripoff.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Next week, is it Beauty and the Beast, or is that baby thing going to happen?
I don't know. Well, the baby reviews are pretty awful right now. And so I don't even know. I mean, I thought the premise of Boss Baby would make it, you know, be a very healthy box office. And it might still have like a $30 million opening or something like that, but it's not going to be Beauty and the Beast.
So. All right, we'll see what I'm interested to see what happens with Ghost in the Shell, just in terms of box office.
Not feeling it.
Yeah, I'm not either. I'm not either.
And probably not screening for critics. They're Paramount. Weren't going to screen it for critics, and then they were saying they were going to screen it on Wednesday, but we haven't received an invite, and I have to check to see if L.A. got invites or not.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a good sign. And I watch the original, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, look, I'm not even a fan of that, Frank.
Oh, okay, I am. Yeah. Okay. All right, Eric, man, we'll talk to you next week. Thanks a lot, man.
Sounds good.
All right, see you later. Eric Childress. All right, we got to take a break here. We got the news coming up right after this on 720 WGN.